Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Before the break, as you were hearing, we were talking about White House Chief of Staff John Kelly and his view of the United States Civil War. Well, it turns out that at virtually the same time, I mean, I'm talking about around the Civil War, in 1857, in Boston, an entirely different conception of what the American idea is was taking shape. And the Atlantic senior editor Yoni Applebaum writes about it. He joins us now from Washington, D.C. to talk about it. And Yoni Applebaum, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be with you again.
It's good to have you. And, you know, it was like kind of almost, it was actually entirely by accident that we had you today alongside this conversation about John Kelly and the Civil War, because it's such an interesting juxtaposition between what you write about Boston, 1857, and the view of the Civil War that Kelly was talking about. So can I just get your quick take on John Kelly's comments?
Sure. John Kelly's reflecting an understanding of this war that has come down to us from a period in which Americans wanted to forget why it was fought. It was a lot easier to reconcile the nation and to rebuild it without grappling with the hard issues that it had posed. And so Kelly is, in some sense, a man of his generation, reflecting a earlier misconception of that war and not really dealing with the ideas and the stakes and the human lives that were bound up in that fight.
Yeah. So tell us then about this entirely different notion of America and the American idea that was taking shape, as you write, in 1857 in Boston that led to the founding of the Atlantic magazine.
Well, this may be tough to imagine today, but there was a moment when American democracy seemed vulnerable to demagogic extremes, when the democratic project around the world felt embattled and in retreat from an assault by authoritarianism, when people were not sure that a pluralistic, diverse democratic society could endure. And in 1857, which was one such moment, a bunch of individuals who were leading literary lights of their own day had dinner at the Parker House Hotel right in Boston, and they set out to do something that was really brash. They set out to create a publication that would contain what they said would be the American idea, and that was doubly brash because first, bold to claim that a relative backwater like America could have an idea that the rest of the world ought to pay attention to, and second, to try to positively define a vision for the country at a moment when most people in America were still defining themselves, increasingly defining themselves by what they opposed.
Right. And so 1857, we have Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, James Elliot Cabot, Oliver Wendell Holmes. I mean, very well-known names here. And the thing that many were starting to define themselves as opposed to, of course, in part was slavery. But you write about how the fact that in the attempt to define this American idea, these leading thinkers had the revelation, or at least the inspiration, that they had to also define themselves as being for something.
Yeah, they really did. And they reached to the work of another Bostonian, the fiery abolitionist preacher Theodore Parker, who had given speeches outlining his conception of the American idea. Parker said that it should be a government of all the people, for all the people, by all the people, right? These are words that will get taken up by other better-known orators a decade later.
Well, but he also gave us the language of the moral arc of the universe, right?
Yeah, and he has this notion that America forms part of that it bends in that direction, or at least that it ought to, that America ought to stand for all people being created equal and possessing unalienable rights and having the opportunity to develop and enjoy those rights. And that was a fairly radical vision in the world of 1857. In Britain, which was nominally democratic, only one in seven adult white males could vote in 1857. In Massachusetts, pretty much every adult male had the right to vote, black and white, propertied or impoverished. And so Boston was already this very unusual place at the time that they're articulating this. But instead of sort of looking around them and seeing the failure of the democratic experiment, these guys decide to double down on it.
Right. But you also write, though, that, I mean, this isn't a pristine political moment in Boston by any means, though, because the city is also, or the state is also, in the grips of know-nothingism, right? And pushback against the waves of incoming immigrants.
Absolutely. And they hold the governor's mansion in the State House at the time that the Atlantic is launched. I should say something that some of these guys will later embrace themselves, this degree of nativism, although not in 1857. Then they are still fighting for a more capacious understanding of human rights. And they commit themselves to this project. And the project gets taken up by Lincoln and by the Republican Party, drawing out of the same mix of ideas, sometimes explicitly citing the Atlantic. And there's a second American founding that happens during the Civil War, a redefinition of the nation around these particular values. Not consensus, not agreement. Nobody agrees on which of these things to prioritize at what moments or how best to achieve them. But they're having an argument in which there's a common set of goals or ideals and then really fierce fights over how to get there.
Yeah. You summarize that common set of goals through the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, "I'm as good as you be." But the reason why I really wanted to talk to you, Yoni, is because later on, deeper in your piece that you wrote in The Atlantic, you write this. You write that the universalism of the left, and we're talking about today, and the cultural nationalism of the right are battering America's sense of common national purpose. Under attack on both flanks and weakened by its failure to deliver exceptional results, the nation's shared identity is crumbling. Now, how long, though, did it take to build up that sense of shared identity after 1857?
Well, it's been an ongoing project. Yeah. And you know, it would be wrong to pretend that this has ever been universally embraced or ever left uncontested. This is a nation with profound injustice in its past. At the same time, there's always been this sense that the nation can be called to account, that we can look at each other and say, this thing that we have done, it does not measure up to our ideals. This is the yardstick by which we'll measure America and we'll see where it's fallen short. If we lose that, if we lose the ability to say, these are the American ideas, this is what this nation stands for, and if we lose the ability to call ourselves on it when we fall short of those ideals, if we retreat into sort of an arid cultural nationalism where we're just proud of ourselves for being ourselves, melt away into a sort of gentle universalism in which there's nothing distinctive or special about America, then we lose the ability to call ourselves to account as well.
Do you give equal weight, though, to the universalism of the left, as you say, and that cultural nationalism of the right in terms of the forces that are weakening our shared identity?
No, they're neither equal in terms of the force that they apply nor the risk that they pose. There's no question that the strong racial or cultural nationalism that Donald Trump and others have promoted is the greater threat. I'd add as well that neither are they separate phenomena. They feed off each other to an extent. If people feel as if a pride in America is fading, they're more likely to turn to that kind of a cultural or racial nationalism. And similarly, if people feel repelled by the nationalisms that they hear people promote, if they don't hear people promoting a nationalism of ideas and ideals, they're more likely to turn away toward universalism. Yeah. So this is a mutually reinforcing cycle.
We've just got a minute to go here, Yoni, and I'm so glad to be able to talk to you today because, you know, I have to remind myself, 1857, the nation is on the doorstep of destruction, right, of the Civil War, of breaking apart, and yet these thinkers came together to say we can champion a positive ideal. Is there's a sense of deep division today? I mean, what's the lesson? We've just got 30 seconds here, but what's the lesson that we can draw from what happened at the Parker House?
You know, they didn't say we need to compromise. What they said was we need to define a vision that we can persuade our fellow Americans to embrace. And that actually is what happens. And they managed to build a nation which moves incrementally and sometimes unevenly toward justice over the ensuing century and a half. That's not a bad standard by which to measure ourselves today.
Yeah. Well, Yoni Applebaum wrote about the American idea and the founding of the Atlantic magazine in Boston in 1857. We have a link to his article at our website, radioboston.org. And Yoni Applebaum is senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees the politics section. Thank you so very much for joining us today. It's very, very appreciated.
Always a pleasure.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.